From KCUR News, this is KC Currents, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. On this week's show, we take a look at some creative approaches to housing and homeless issues in Kansas City.
Sometimes, honestly, we even sat at bus stops till daylight, where my babies had to fall asleep on my lap.
Hear about the diverse roots of KC's Baha'i community and visit a local instrument maker who's working for some top jazz artists.
The way that a bell is made is definitely going to have the biggest impact on how the horn plays and sounds.
Plus, a dip into KC's radio past.
This is cowboy music to the hilt with the hats. They sang songs about their horses and about shootouts and about the prairie.
Listen up for KC Currents just after this hour's news. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson. KC Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
On this special membership edition of KC Currents, we're going to look back at some of the stories we did in the past few months that looked at housing issues in Kansas City.
What little new housing that's being built in this country right now is being closely geared to the ways the American economy and its society are changing. Fewer sprawling suburbs, more urban living. Demographics are shifting. And here in Kansas City, developers have opened a unique apartment complex that caters to a very specific family dynamic. Sylvia checked it out back in September.
Oh, there she is.
Hi, Mom. Don't run so fast.
62-year-old Emma Williams is picking up her 3-year-old granddaughter, Lyric, at Head Start.
I had 5 of my own. So you know I wasn't planning on raising children. Oh, God, no.
But Williams' daughter, Lyric's mom, has a drug problem, and Williams says she's already lost one grandchild to protective services. So when Lyric was a month old, Williams took her in.
That's my sugar. To mess with her, you might as well spit on me.
Williams was living in a one-bedroom trailer at the time. She couldn't move into senior housing with the child, so when she heard about Pemberton Park, she said her prayers were answered. It was an entire apartment complex designed exclusively for grandparents raising grandchildren. Williams and Lyric moved into their two-bedroom apartment in June. It has a central room with living and dining spaces that open into a kitchen with a big island in it.
Get the milk. I can get the milk.
This is one of 36 apartments at Pemberton Park. Like senior housing, they're handicap accessible with wide doorways, rails in the bathrooms, and low cabinets. Outside, there's a playground with a ramp for wheelchairs and activity rooms and a computer lab, which 13-year-old Sean Gasway appreciates. He's making friends, and he admits it's hard to get out of line here.
It's a lot of grandmas in these apartments.
A lot of grandmas. Pemberton Park opened in March, and 2/3 of the apartments are now filled, mostly with grandmothers and their grandchildren. Brian Collins envisioned this project. He's with a local developer, Cougar Capital.
It's sometimes unusual that a project comes to you where not only does it make sense economically and commercially, but it tugs at your heartstrings, too.
Collins had read about a similar project in the Bronx, the nation's first grand family apartments, which opened 6 years ago. He found out there are some 15,000 households in the Kansas City area headed by grandparents, and many are below poverty level. He held focus groups with grandparents to find out what their needs were.
Those households needed support with the children, especially after school, helping with their homework. Grandparents needed a place to get away from the kids.
Cougar Capital partnered with the city to receive tax credits from the state and federal government. The Kansas City project is one of a half dozen around the country, which are all public housing of some sort. But with 2.7 million grandparents raising grandchildren around the country, other developers are paying attention. Donna Butts heads the group Generations United and has tracked the growth of grand family housing.
We've been approached in the last several years from for-profit developers who are realizing that the communities of the future are not what the communities of the past look like. I think there's a growing need for housing for multi-generational households.
How are you doing?
Fine, how are you?
Hi.
Good, good.
Back in Kansas City, Pemberton Park residents are getting to know each other. There's a Halloween party in the works. City officials say they've never seen this level of community in a public housing project. With her granddaughter sitting on her lap, Emma Williams says it's changed her.
Before I moved here, I was one of those. You see me coming in, you see me go out, and that's all you done was see me. And they have made me come out of my shell. You know, so we sit out front sometimes and just talk till it's dark outdoors.
With grandmas leading the way, the proverbial village just might be coming back.
We checked in about a month ago, and there are still some units available at Pemberton Park, just off Swope Parkway, here in Kansas City. More than 10,000 people are now homeless in the Kansas City area, but finding a way to get around to appointments, to shelters, can mean a difference between breaking that cycle of homelessness and winding up back on the streets. The challenge has added strain to area emergency rooms and the community at large, but lately one man has taken on the problem head on, giving rides around the clock to people in need. KCUR's Alana Gordon recently rode along with Car Wu and found out how a seemingly simple gesture has set in motion some dramatic changes.
Are we ready? Come on.
On a late fall afternoon, Car Wu picks up Brooke Birdsong and her two young children from a downtown family shelter. Birdsong needs a way to get her 7-month-old, who's been sick for over a week, to the hospital. Until 1 a.m. every day, Car Wu, a slender man with dark, shoulder-length hair that's graying around his ears, drives around this brightly painted minivan with the Gandhi quote, "Be the change," printed in big red letters on the side. He drives the van between hospitals, domestic violence shelters, schools, bridges, treatment centers, even jails, helping people who are homeless.
They're surprised at what we do. They say, you're just going to take us to a safe place without charging us? No questions asked.
How are you doing?
Oh, hello, Wu. I'm glad to see you.
Yeah, I saw you walking. Are you okay?
Wu slows down next to a guy walking with a crutch on 47th Street.
Okay. I can take you there real quick. Come on, okay. Get in.
Wu's driven around so much, he burned out his first van. He has two now, and two staff members to help him. He takes calls directly from people and from hospitals, shelters, even libraries. But Wu emphasizes his group is not a cab service.
A taxi cab can go to a hospital, pick up a patient, drop them off. That's it.
Instead, during that maybe 20-minute ride, Wu gets to know people, and he follows up with them, sometimes for months, taking them to appointments, checking in on them, and connecting them with services. Wu didn't plan to do this kind of work. Wu grew up in Hong Kong. He came to the States for school with barely any money and barely speaking the language. He spent close to 30 years working in retail, selling art and making it. It was only when he moved his art store 5 years ago to a spot on the plaza next to Mill Creek Park that Wu, rather inadvertently, started connecting with people who were homeless.
And then I walk my dog every day with my look, and I have a Dalmatian, so we are very friendly looking.
People would approach him. He also served food in the park with volunteers every Sunday. Soon enough, Wu's art shop was looking more and more like a drop-in center for people. Meanwhile, across the street, St. Luke's, like many other hospitals across the country, was trying to figure out what to do about homeless people who were coming to the ER, not because of a heart attack or other health emergency, but for things like food and shelter. Staff said it wasn't a good use of emergency room resources. It wasn't addressing people's ongoing problems either. But when St. Luke's learned about Wu, they approached him one day in the park and talked to him about setting up a citywide transportation program. Wu saw transportation as a big barrier for people. He decided to close his art business. And since he started giving rides 2 years ago, he's cut in half the number of homeless visits to St. Luke's ER. Around 8 p.m., Wu gets a call from St. Luke's. When he gets there, 48-year-old John Autry is resting on a stretcher. His clothes are stained with fresh blood. Autry follows Wu to the car.
I got punched in the nose by another supposed homeless person.
Wu hands Autry his card, talks with him a bit, and brings him to a shelter. Wu says he doesn't think about why a person's in the crisis they're in. Instead, he focuses on what's best for them in that moment. He also doesn't ask anyone to change.
It's always, if you're ready, if you want to, we will be there for you. Because that approach is a little bit more realistic, because you can't ask people to change. When is the last time you and I changed? Because someone said, oh, you didn't do this right, do it, change. But we don't. We do the way we wanted to do. So, but our approach is we don't judge. We don't do anything. We just say, when you're ready, you call us and we'll be there for you.
For Jim Ault, a biker with a curly ponytail and a meth addiction, who now volunteers for WHO, that happened this past summer.
A friend of mine told me about him and said that he'd be, you know, good to talk to about things that I needed to, and he'd understand me more than anybody else.
When we first met him, we literally pulled him off the creek. He was at Brush Creek, soaking wet, and he was having an episode of issues. For some reason, he called me.
And you had never met him before?
I never met him before. Good evening. Okay, what is her goal? What does she need? Does she need to go to a shelter tonight? What is the goal?
By the time it hits 1 in the morning, Wu has made a lot more stops throughout the metro. But he says these long days don't bother him. Wu says he's looking forward to tomorrow and the day after that, when he'll get to follow up with more people whenever they call, whether that be day or night. Alana Gordon, KCUR News.
This story first ran back in December.
A new transitional living program opened this fall. It's for homeless women who are trying to get their lives back together and make the transition to a stable home. The Freedom House on 31st and Charlotte in Midtown provides a home for 4 homeless women and was built almost entirely on small contributions and the work of volunteers. Susan paid a visit in early November when the first residents moved in.
When I got to Freedom House, the newest 2 residents were waiting to bring their stuff in from the car. There wasn't much to bring. For both of them, Freedom House was the first real home they'd had in some time. 33-year-old Camilla Patterson had been in and out of shelters, staying with friends, and on the streets for 3 years. She realized her problem started early in life. She had a hearing problem no one paid attention to. She dropped out of school, married, and had children very young. The marriage was rocky, and a series of moves and evictions followed.
Sometime, honestly, we even sat at bus stops till daylight, where my babies had to fall asleep on my lap.
Freedom House is what's called a transitional living program that focuses on providing the skills and nurturing women need to be able to get back on their feet. Freedom House does not have room for children, in part so that women can focus on themselves and in rebuilding a stable life. Camilla felt she made the right decision to leave her children temporarily.
It feels a lot better for them to be able to say, well, this time we don't want to go to the shelter, if we could just stay with Dad.
For another resident named Stephanie Russell, a domino effect of multiple problems and setbacks led to her homelessness.
Getting a car that I could not afford and trying to keep my car, and I was having back problems, and the store that I was working at closed down with no notice.
Russell has been sleeping in and out of her car for the past 2 years. Both of the women I talked to had tried shelters at some point, but the shelter system doesn't work to help get homeless people on their feet. Freedom House was the vision of one woman, Nazarene pastor and former social worker Alice Piggy Wallach.
I've been there. My life has been a journey. I've had some tough times. I've had times that I didn't particularly have any confidence in my abilities.
Pastor Alice's True Light Ministry began in the year 2000, and its congregation now has about 65 people. They began the ministry doing street outreach near 27th and Troost, attempting to bring hope and encouragement to the homeless, to sex workers, and others down on their luck. In 2006, Pastor Alice then started a resource center for mothers and children. She quickly realized that women sleeping in shelters at night had nowhere to go during the day. So Emancipation Station was born in 2007. to provide a safe place where women could be linked with resources and support during the day.
This is the kitchen. This is our kitchen here. And we are planning to have our nutritionist that come out on Tuesdays, and she's going to help us plan menus as we go on until we get more familiar with what we need to do, and then we can do it on our own.
Eventually, Pastor Alice and a crew of volunteers transformed a dilapidated two-story house near 31st and Charlotte into a comfortable and safe haven for four women. Like the house, Pastor Alice hopes to transform the lives of the women who come here for 3 months to a year.
We're to eat as a family on a nightly basis every night and sit around the table. And each one of the ladies will be responsible to make a dinner every night.
The renovation of the house was made possible through donations from Home Depot and volunteer help. It took about a year and a half. Women at Freedom House don't pay rent, but they contribute food stamps for their meals and provide service to the ministry and to the community. They also receive case management services to link them with resources like jobs, training, and health services that can help them become self-sufficient. But the road to transformation for some women is not an easy one. Pastor Alice says she has been surprised by how some women do not like the rules and structure that are important to building a new life. Two women have left Freedom House since its opening.
We were surprised to find out that everyone who said that they wanted a house, all right, a place to live in, had agreed to the rules and regulations, were not able to adhere to those rules and regulations. I was so surprised that one could say that, well, I'd rather live in my car.
As for the new residents of Freedom House, having a place to call home means a lot. As Stephanie Russell says,
no more sleeping in my car, no more worrying about where I'm going to eat at, take a shower at, sleep. I'm free now.
Now Pastor Alice is looking ahead and thinking about how she can nurture the skills and talents of those in her congregation. Her goal, to help them realize they have something to contribute and at the same time find a small stream of income.
Each week on Casey Currents, we try to get out and about in Kansas City to take you to places like the Freedom House, inside Car Woo's van, and the new Grand Families housing complex. We aim to introduce you to people you might not meet otherwise. It's what makes Casey Currents different from our talk shows, which happen mostly in studio.
But that kind of shoe leather reporting is expensive. We hope that during our membership drive this week, you'll think about contributing to KCUR to help support our work here on Casey Currents. We're not fundraising during the rest of the show this hour, but you can call anytime at 816-235-5287. That's 816-235-5287, or go online to kcur.org.
And coming up now, we visit the workshop of a master craftsman of trumpets and trombones. You're listening to Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. Every 19 days, members of Kansas City's Baha'i religious community gather for a potluck and a traditional service they call a feast. It's a remarkably diverse mix of races, ages, and backgrounds, celebrating a 150-year-old gospel of global unity. But the optimistic spirit of many of Kansas City's Baha'i has been tested. Many have fled for their lives in order to practice their religion. Alex Smith has that story.
The beginning of every account is the name of God. O friends of God, incline your inner ears to the voice of the peerless and the self-subsisting Lord.
The Kansas City Baha'i Center is in a former bank building on Independence Avenue. Here at a recent Baha'i service, about 40 of Kansas City's 400 community members take turns reading from Scripture, and some offer songs and poetry. When Badir Ashraghi's turn comes around, he quietly sings a prayer in Persian, reminding the group of their religion's Iranian origins. The diversity of the group is no accident. In fact, you could almost say it's the point. Baha'i is a religion with a goal. The faith seeks to break down racial, cultural, and economic boundaries to achieve peace and stability for the planet. And its scriptures offer a very specific plan on how to do that. This focus on unity is what brings many people like Earl Moore to Baha'i.
One of the things that attracted me to the faith was because I came up during the 60s and all that. And I found that so many things that we were trying weren't complete. They didn't have a complete answer. And I saw the Baha'i faith as the complete answer to the race problem in America and the problems of inequality around the world. It's a complete package.
Baha'i was founded in 1866 by an Iranian called Baha'u'llah, but Baha'is believe that his teachings and writings are just the latest in a series of sacred revelations. Baha'is believe that all the world's major practices, Zoroastrianism, Hinduism, Buddhism, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, are all aspects of the same basic religion. And some Baha'is refer to the teachings of Baha'u'llah as the latest update. Baha'i has no hierarchy or clergy. Instead, local communities elect a group of nine to an assembly which serves as an administration. Kansas actually has a special connection to Baha'i. The second assembly in the Western Hemisphere was founded in the small town of Enterprise, Kansas, in 1897.
Refresca y alegra mi espíritu. Purifica mi corazón.
For a group that prides itself on tolerance, Baha'is have drawn a lot of intolerance, especially in Iran, where the religion originated. Ever since Baha'i began, its followers have come under attack by fundamentalist Muslims. An early incarnation of Baha'is, the Babis, saw 200,000 of their members killed in the mid-19th century. And Baha'i's founder, Baha'u'llah, spent most of his life either in prison or in exile. Badir Ishraghi explains the problem some fundamentalist Muslims have with Baha'i.
Their opposition to Baha'is is that they say that, you know, the Muslim faith, the last religion, according to their Quran, that Muhammad was the last prophet. And that's based on that, you know, they say, hey, any religion come after them, they are not true. And that's why they do not accept.
Baha'is are the largest minority group in Iran, but in a country that is 98% Muslim, they're just a sliver of the population. Zabi Karam is one of Kansas City's Iranian-born Baha'is. They make up about a quarter of the Kansas City community. Karam grew up in the small town of Yazd in the 50s and 60s when there were about a half a million Baha'is in the country. In Yazd, like in all of Iran, Baha'is and Muslims lived in the same neighborhoods and attended the same schools. But Zabi says he realized at an early age life was different for Baha'is.
The first time that I realized that we are being different was the time that I didn't see some of our cousins on my mother's side. And when I asked my mother, how come so-and-so is not here, they said, well, they don't like to come to our house because we are Baha'is and they are Muslim. And they don't consider Baha'is as you know, sociable and clean, and they're dirty, you know, like here they call people pig, you know. So in Iran those days, anywhere you went, at the stores, most stores, they had signs, it said, for Muslims only. And there were places that you would go, it was a public place that you would go get water. And there were usually two dispensary or two faucets. One, it says, for Muslim only, and the other one says others.
Starting in 1841, Iran was ruled by a Shah, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi. But to win the support of fundamentalist Muslim leaders, the Shah turned his back when these leaders spoke out against Baha'is. By the mid-1950s, these leaders were preaching violence in sermons and on the radio. Zabi Karam says the Baha'is of Iran learned to live with the looming threat of violence.
Things were never really calm and quiet, if I can say, because I know from the time I remember growing up, we were always beaten by the kids, especially kids at school, you know. It got to the point that I thought getting beat up is part of Baha'i, you know, you're to be beat up. As Baha'i and grow up.
As Karam grew up, he learned more about the history of Baha'is in Iran and how his family fit into that history. Karam is a fourth generation Baha'i, but in those four generations, 19 members of his extended family have been killed because of their religion.
The one that I've always heard about is my dad's uncle. He was a baker, and the mobs or people, they just picked him up and threw him in the oven, and that's how he died. He just burned in that baking oven.
After his father suffered an especially severe attack, the family fled to live in Pakistan for 2 years. Zabi eventually came to the United States, where he studied industrial management at KU in Central Missouri State. When he graduated in the mid-70s, he returned to Iran because there was a great demand for highly educated workers. He got a job as a factory manager, but soon discovered that anti-Baha'i feelings were still strong.
After about 3 months, one day I had a call from the owner of the company, who was living in Tehran, and he called me in and he said, I need to talk to you. And I said, sure. So I went there and he started talking to me. And first he started praising, you're doing a great job. And I immediately knew where he's going, because I was waiting for that but, that big but drops, And so after saying all that, he said, but there is one problem. And I said, and I acted dumb, and I said, what's that? He said, well, we were told that you are Baha'i. He said, well, people are prejudiced, people are not educated, and we can't have that. And he wanted me to go back and tell him that he said, tell him whatever, tell him anything else but Baha'i. Tell him you're Zoroaster, or you're Jew or Christian or anything, but not Baha'i. And I said, listen, first of all, I haven't told anybody. The second thing is, I'm not going to deny my faith for nothing. Even if you give me the company, I'm not going to say that. He said, well, we can't have it. I said, to me, there's only two options. One is for me to leave. The other thing is for me to go back as is. You pick. He said, well, we don't want you to leave, but we can't have you there either. I said, well, in that case, I resign.
In the 70s, the situation for Baha'is was bad, but it was about to get a lot worse. The Shah was on the verge of being overthrown by fundamentalist Muslims. Led by Ayatollah Khomeini, these radicals said the Shah had become a pawn of the U.S. and Western Europe. Many Baha'is, including Zabi Karam and Badir Ishraghi, realized the social climate was shifting and they fled the country. At a recent Baha'i potluck, Riaz Rabbani sits at the head of a table. He's joined with his family to celebrate the birth of Baha'i's founder, Baha'u'llah. Today, Rabbani is a cardiologist living in the Kansas City suburbs, but he was not yet a preteen when the Iranian Revolution happened in 1979. Under the new government, Baha'is were forbidden from practicing their religion, attending college, or holding any government job. Since the government controlled most companies, the only job option for most Baha'is was starting a business, and most private businesses owned by or employing Baha'is could be taken over by the government. Rabbani says Baha'is were basically stuck, unable to get passports.
One of the precepts of the Baha'i faith is that you cannot deny your faith, meaning that if somebody asks you what your religion is, you have to say that you're a Baha'i. You cannot say you're not. And it would have been very easy, because to get a passport, what kept Baha'is from getting a passport was a little box on the application asking for what your religion is. And if you wrote Muslim or Christian or Jew, nobody would have asked the question and you would have gotten a passport.
After a few years under the new regime, Riaz Rabbani and his family were able to get smuggled to Turkey and eventually received political asylum in the United States.
Save God. Save
But escaping to the United States isn't the end of the story for many Baha'is. Since terrorist actions like the 1979 Iranian hostage crisis and 9/11, many Middle Eastern immigrants have faced discrimination in the United States, and Iranian Baha'is are no exception. Community member Matt Reinschmidt explains.
Over here, of course, there's a lot of leftover angst and some hard feelings for sure from 9/11. And a lot of the Baha'is that come over here catch some of that from other people in the United States that saw 9/11 happen and they see this Middle Eastern looking person, they think, oh, you must be a Muslim or one of the people that was behind this event that hammered our country. And it's like, no, I had to flee for my life from those people too. I'm not one of them.
The situation for Baha'is in Iran hasn't changed much since the revolution. The government policies have forced Baha'i practice to go underground. The number of Baha'is in Iran have dropped to 300,000, and according to Amnesty International, 202 Baha'is have been killed. Iran claims that it doesn't persecute Baha'is because of their religion. Instead, they claim Baha'is are Zionist spies. But according to Zabi Karam, there is hope.
The government feeling toward Baha'is has not changed. People have changed, though. Generally, most people now have a more positive view of Baha'i faith. And that is due to there are a lot of TV stations in the United States as well as Europe that broadcast, and Iranians are watching it. And there, quite often there's a discussion of religion, and they're either in the form of panel or the question and answer, and they discuss. So people are becoming more open-minded as they understand the Baha'i faith. And thanks to internet and computer, they can go in and read and study it.
The international Baha'i community has worked hard to protest the persecution of Baha'is, and their grassroots efforts have been surprisingly effective. Zabi Karam's brother, Azad Ullah, who stayed in Iran, was sentenced to be executed in the 80s, but he was freed after an international letter-writing campaign. Recently, many of Kansas City's Baha'is, both Iranian and American-born, have been lobbying Missouri's representatives in the U.S. House to condemn Iran's treatment of Baha'is. The proposed House Resolution 134 is currently pending in the House Subcommittee on Africa, Global Health, and Human Rights. For Casey Currents, this is Alex Smith.
We first aired this story in December. A few weeks ago, on March 29th, the U.S. Senate passed a resolution which condemned Iran for the persecution of Baha'is and called on the country to release people who are in prison because of their religion. A similar resolution is pending in the House. In the 6.5 years since Hurricane Katrina devastated New Orleans, a local man has played a role in bringing that signature brass sound back to the streets. For Casey Current's regular Odd Job segment, Sylvia paid a visit to this master craftsman in Olathe, who is custom making instruments for some of the top jazz musicians in the country.
Horn shop is a pretty noisy place. And it's not just trumpet players testing for sticky valves. If you go behind the store to the workshop, you'll find it actually takes sound to make sound.
Sound is very much a part of our world.
Mike Corrigan calls himself the horn doctor. He shows me around his 5,000-square-foot warehouse, which is tucked away in an industrial park in Olathe. Hundreds of instrument cases are piled everywhere. Corrigan flicks a switch next to an old bathtub where instruments get cleaned. Even that involves some noise.
So we turn that on. And what that does is that high-pitched frequency will actually shake out all the debris in the instrument to get all the dirt out of it.
Corrigan knows the physics, chemistry, and geometry behind making music. From the unique properties of materials like brass, copper, and silver, to the angle of a bend on a hornbell. Most instruments nowadays are stamped out in modern factories, but Corrigan loves the magic of metalsmithing techniques that go back to 16th century hornmakers.
The way they were made didn't change very much. I could picture myself going back in time, and if I was to go back in time, I could, you know, do this.
Some of the first instruments Corrigan began making were for historical collections, like the German sackbut, which is a precursor to the trombone, and the Baroque natural trumpet, which has no valves. But now he's making custom instruments for professional musicians who perform on Broadway and in jazz, pop, and even rap music.
Corgan says what all these instruments have in common, the most important part, is that flared end, the bell.
The way that a bell is made is definitely going to have the biggest impact on how the horn plays and sounds.
A typical trumpet or trombone starts out as a sheet cut from a roll of yellow brass. Corrigan's antique brass cutter works like a giant can opener. He cuts a shape that looks like a Y.
And then we'll hand cut these little notches all the way down on one side. We will actually hand zip this all the way up. When we get it all finished, it's brazed with a high temperature silver solder. And then from that point, you'll have a flat piece like this that gets hammered out on an anvil. When we're getting the form kind of roughed out, we're using a variety of different anvils and big different mallets.
The horn is then slipped over a steel mandrel, which is like a form for the shape. If it needs to be bent, it's filled with hot pitch and then cooled.
And that pitch keeps the tube from buckling and collapsing.
The end of the bell is shaped on a spinning lathe. Corrigan leans into it with a long rod that has a knob at the end. This is one of his favorite parts. He says very few instrument makers hand spin bells anymore. It's time consuming and physically challenging.
You gotta put a lot of weight into that to get the metal to move. This is pretty thick material I'm working with.
After a few minutes of spinning, the metal gets brittle. Corrigan has to pull it off and heat it with a blowtorch until it glows red and softens up again. There's a lot more to making the smaller components. For trumpets, they still need to order a few parts. But Corrigan says they make 100% of their trombones in-house. He actually started this company based on his reputation for repairing trombone slides. You know, those long parallel tubes that slip in and out.
We have a special process for polishing the slides so they feel like butter. That's what we like to tell people, they feel like butter.
And that's kind of what it feels like as it moves.
Yeah, real smooth. You want it just to be real nice and smooth and fast. So when a musician is playing a lot of quick notes, they don't have to be fighting their horn and have the slide interfering with what they are thinking in their head, because we want them to be able to portray their voice and their thoughts that they have with their music without having any difficulty from their equipment.
You're listening to the Mason Brothers Quintet. One of the brothers is Elliot Mason, the trombone player for Wynton Marsalis' Lincoln Center Jazz Orchestra. And that horn he's playing? It's a Corrigan. Mike Corrigan grew up in Maryland and started playing trumpet in middle school. He was really inspired by his band director in high school.
He and I would sit down and disassemble instruments and clean them and try to fix them, and he'd show me what he knew. And he actually discovered a school for band instrument repair, and he was real impressed with that. He'd never heard of it before, and I thought it sounded like a lot of fun.
There's actually only a few instrument repair schools around the country. Corrigan went to Minnesota State Southeast Technical, a program known as Red Wing. It was only after he graduated that he got the idea that he could actually construct an instrument from scratch.
After repair school, my teacher came up to me and said, "Mike, I think you would really enjoy making horns." And I said to him, I didn't even think of that. You know, I guess somebody's got to make them.
So from there, Corrigan apprenticed at a Boston manufacturer of custom brass instruments. He moved to Overland Park in 2004 because his wife had grown up in the area. Corrigan started his new business in his home.
It started in the small shop in my basement, and then it moved to my garage, and I had my garage and my basement. And then the rest of the basement, our living room in the basement, became a showroom, and the shop started to consume our living space. So that was the point we needed to move out.
So in 2007, he set up shop in Olathe. Corrigan's now just 31, and he has 11 employees at BAC Horn Doctor. BAC stands for Best American Craftsman. The shop also repairs woodwinds now, and one of his guys is doing elaborate engravings. They've started working with area schools and more local musicians, saxophone player Bobby Watson and trumpeter Herman Mahari, to name a couple. But Corrigan's reputation is probably growing faster in New Orleans. He made his first trip there the year after Hurricane Katrina.
I know a lot of people were going down to New Orleans to help rebuild houses and help with the cleanup and all that. But what I decided to do is bring the repair shop down, set up and just repair horns for the musicians down there. I thought, that's what I do. That's something that I can provide. And I thought that would be a genuine help.
Corgan and an employee drove down with their repair truck, which is a converted concession stand. They set up in the parking lot of a church in Treme, the traditional musicians' neighborhood, the one that HBO series is about. And they waited.
We were real concerned because not a lot of people showed up. And we had a few people come in and out. And it was almost noontime when I remember this gentleman, Jamie, who's a great singer down in New Orleans, shows up with a saxophone. And then I can't do his New Orleans draw. He kind of sounded like Harry Connick Jr. Is where is everybody? And we thought, we don't know. We're here to fix horns. At that point, we said, we don't know where everybody is. And he says, you know what? These are musicians. They're sleeping still. And we thought, oh, of course. They're not going to wake up at 8 o'clock in the morning. So he said, don't worry. They're going to start showing up. I'll make a couple of calls. And sure enough, just before noon, the word got out, and we suddenly had a huge pile of people outside.
Corrigan says there were a lot of teenagers there, and he was worried because it was a school night.
I was a little concerned, first of all, being in this area late at night, at midnight, and I don't know anybody. I was a little concerned about that. But when all these kids were waiting for their friends to get their horns done, when we finished that last horn that first night, The kids all said, well, we want to show you that we thank you for fixing our horns. We're going to play you a song. And I'm thinking, it is midnight. That's all right, guy. You don't need to do that. They said, no, we want to show you our appreciation. So I said, all right. And they start wailing. There was probably a group of about, 18 or 20 kids, and they're just wailing, playing. Oh, they're just blowing really loud, and it sounded awesome. It was great. But in the back of my mind, I'm really concerned because it's midnight. I don't want people upset people. And then I start noticing people are coming out of their houses, and now I'm getting really nervous. But instead of yelling about the noise, they come out. They start clapping and dancing around, and I'm thinking, where on earth am I right now? This is crazy.
Corgan has ended up going down to New Orleans once or twice a year to repair instruments. He's gotten to know a lot of people and recently received a proclamation from the mayor thanking him for his service to the musicians of New Orleans. He's become particularly close to Trombone Shorty, who's a rising jazz star. Shorty's playing here with the Rebirth Brass Band, who just won a Grammy for their album The Rebirth of New Orleans. All but one of the musicians are blowing, you guessed it, Mike Corgan's horns. Corgan sometimes works with musicians for years to develop prototypes for instruments that can create the sounds they have in their heads. Elliot Mason's the trombonist who plays at Lincoln Center. He's traveled here some 10 times from New York on a quest with Corgan to create the perfect trombone, or at least the perfect one for Mason's style.
He's got a very unique sound. The best way to say it is it's very dark, like a milk chocolate sound, if you will. But he has such skill for jazz improv, and he thinks so quickly. So when you hear his approach when he's soloing and playing, it genuinely is his own voice. And he thinks so fast that he needs an instrument that is really flexible and has a lot of agility so he can get all over the horn. But at the same time, it's got this, like I say, milk chocolate sound.
All all musicians want a good sounding horn, but some are more about the looks.
We made a horn for a gentleman who does a lot. He's played with P. Diddy and Jay-Z and Maxwell. He's very in the pop scene of things. And from his perspective, he obviously it's very important to have a horn that plays really well and does what he wants it to do. But he wanted something that also looked very unique. So now we get into the design and the character and the personality of the person aesthetically, not just how they sound. So that horn is very unique looking. It was all green, but it kind of changed colors as you walked past it, like a custom chopper or the car or something like that. And the bell bent up like a Dizzy Gillespie, and the bell was removable.
Corgan got into all this because he loves working with his hands, cutting and soldering and spinning metal. But all the time and attention makes these custom instruments expensive, starting at $3,000 or $4,000. He's succumbed to mass production for a few less costly instruments that he designed. But in the end, Corgan says there's nothing like hearing the results of all his labor. The first time it happened, he was at a Broadway show.
The stage lowered and you saw the musicians, and I realized that was a trombone that I made. That was one of the horns. And seeing that on Broadway, it made me realize that although I decided to pursue the technician side of things and devote my life to repair, you know, sure, if I had more time to study music, I might be more of a proficient musician. But the reality of it is I make them now and I repair them. And I do play, but not to the level where I'd get a Broadway gig. But when I saw that, that was a piece of me on that stage. And that was really, really cool.
Mike Corgan hopes to move his Olathe shop to downtown KC someday to be closer to the music scene and to the musicians, if New Orleans doesn't steal him away.
After the break, I listen back to KC's Radio Past. This is KC Currents.
This is KC Currents. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.
And I'm Susan Wilson.
DJs pride themselves on the rare grooves they can dig up and play for audiences. But there's another kind of audio lover who searches for artifacts of eras gone by, whether it's radio broadcasts, commercials, or speeches. In a series we call Crate Diggers, we're bringing you some of those stories of the search for lost sound. Alex Smith has this one about Rebecca Pryor, her grandfather Charlie, and Kansas City's legendary Western Swing radio program, the Brush Creek Follies.
To Rebecca Pryor, her grandfather Charlie was a kind of Pied Piper. Everywhere he went, he made music that thrilled audiences. Charlie Pryor was a percussionist, specializing in drum set, xylophone, and a homemade musical washboard souped up with cowbells and horns. When she was little, Charlie took Rebecca with him to play at churches, and he played at her school's assemblies.
One of my favorite memories from childhood, when he would come around and do assemblies and performances at the schools that I went to, was that he would play Flight of the Bumblebee. So he would hold two mallets in each hand and play Flight of the Bumblebee. And anyway, it was a very rapid-fire song, and he never missed a note.
Charlie Pryor died in 1983 in his early 70s, and Rebecca assumed she would never hear his music again. Part of the Pryor family legend included stories about Charlie's career as a professional musician from the 30s to the 50s, but the real extent of his early career had mostly faded from the family's memory. But in 1999, Charlie's wife died, and the family discovered old Charlie Pryor artifacts like photos and letters in her estate. Inspired to learn more, Rebecca Pryor called Chuck Haddix. He's better known to KCUR listeners as Chuck Haddix, the host of The Fish Fry. But in his day job, Chuck works as director of the Mar Sound Archives. They're located in the basement floor of UMKC's main library and home to every old recording you can think of, plus a lot more you can't. Chuck pulled from deep in the archive stacks and was able to give Rebecca actual recordings of her grandfather in performance taken from radio transcription discs more than a half century old. During
his years as a professional musician, which lasted from the 30s to the 50s, Charlie Pryor worked mainly with two groups, the Tune Chasers and the Midland Minstrels. It was Western swing music, influenced more by jazz and the Old West than by hillbilly folk music. According to Chuck Haddix, Kansas City was home to an impressive Western swing scene from the 1930s to the 50s.
Usually what you had was a group of four or five individuals. They all dressed alike in Western gear. This is cowboy music to the hilt with the hats and, you know, the cowboy outfits. They sang songs about their horses and about shootouts and about the prairie and the Western themes.
The center of Kansas City's Western swing scene and the source of many of Charlie Pryor's recordings was the Brush Creek Follies. This was an hour-long show that aired live on Saturday nights on KMBC Radio beginning in 1938. It started at the Ivanhoe Temple, then moved to Municipal Auditorium and later Memorial Hall, before finally settling into the Downtown Theater, which ultimately became home to the Lyric Opera.
Come on, everybody, get ready, let's go. This is the Brush Creek Follies Show.
What they would hear when they tuned in, they would hear, of course, the intro, the theme. Then the Hiram Higbee would come out, and he would tell a joke and introduce the band.
Yes, sir, and they got a tune that fits right in with the Beard Night.
Then various groups would come up and perform. They had a lot of interesting people like Kit and Kay, and these twins that yodeled and played the guitar. There was also Bud and Spud. Yeah.
Brother, there's a flying fortress heading right for your house.
Oh, get on out of here.
The Texas Rangers appeared on there sometimes. And it was kind of a corny thing. If you think about Hee-Haw, you know, for example, Hee-Haw's this rooted in that tradition.
Even in the golden age of radio, the Brush Creek Follies was one of the biggest music programs in the country, second only to Chicago's Barn Dance. The Brush Creek Follies even had a stronger signal than the Grand Ole Opry. Charlie Pryor's bands, the Midland Minstrels and the Tune Chasers, served for years as part of the Brush Creek Follies stable of regular musicians. Here's Charlie Pryor in his glory, live on the Brush Creek Follies, playing a characteristically impassioned washboard solo. The Brush Creek Follies radio show came to an end in the mid-50s as KMBC shifted toward television. Not long after that, Charlie Pryor stepped away from being a country music star. Chuck Haddix says that since Marr started archiving Brush Creek Follies material, they've heard from lots of the cast's family members, and their collection is still growing. They've started a website with Brush Creek Follies clips and history. This is Alex Smith for KCUR News.
Well, that's it for KC Currents this week. It was our special membership edition, giving you a taste for the kind of reporting we're always striving to do here. Local, sound rich, introducing you to the real-life characters and settings of your town.
If you like the kind of reporting we do on KC Currents, please consider becoming a member of KCUR or renewing your membership this week. You can call 816-235-5287. That's 816-235-5287. Or go online to kcur.org.
KC Currents is produced by Sylvia with assistant producer Alex Smith. Carrie Coogan is our intern, and our theme music is by Approach. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Sylvia Maria Gross.